This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Why so many police are handling the protests wrong was the headline of an article earlier this month, co-written by my guest Jamiles Larte. Another recent article he co-wrote was about why Minneapolis police failed to adopt reforms and remove bad officers before George Floyd's death. Larte is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that describes itself as seeking to create and sustain a sense of national urgency about the U.S. criminal justice system. It's named after Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. Larte previously reported on criminal justice, race, and policing for the U.S. edition of The Guardian. He was part of the Guardian team that created an online database tracking police violence in 2015 and 2016. That project, called The Counted, revealed the number of people killed by law enforcement and told the stories of who they were and how they died. The project found the rate of death for young black men was 5 times higher than white men of the same age. In 2015, FBI Director James Comey said, "It's unacceptable that the Washington Post and the Guardian newspaper are becoming the lead source of information about violent encounters between U.S. police and civilians." In 2016, the National Association of Black Journalists named Larte the Michael J. Feeney Emerging Journalist of the Year. Jamiles Larte, welcome to Fresh Air. So I want to ask you about an article that you co-wrote that was published on June 1st, and this was after peaceful protests in several cities were capped with, you know, looting and some arson and confrontations with police. And it was hard to tell sometimes, like, were these the protesters? Were these just, like, opportunists using the protests as an excuse to loot? But you wrote an article about research that shows how crowds of protesters and crowds of police behave and what happens when the two interact and how disproportionate police force can make a peaceful protest not so peaceful. What are some of the things that you've learned by studying the research about how police can escalate the situation through tough tactics?
So I want to start with what you mentioned about, you know, that there were these kind of different waves happening or these different moments in protest where we didn't know if it was opportunists or it was I think it is important to think to keep in mind that to the extent that there's been destructive acts at protests, looting, that there's a range of causes, right? Are there passionate, angry people who were lashing out in grief and frustration? Yes. Are there anti-capitalists who see looting and destruction as a form of revolutionary praxis and are using this as an opportunity? Yes. Are there pure opportunists who want to get free stuff and are taking advantage of the chaos? Definitely. Are there chaos agents who are trying to give the protesters a bad name and potentially seed violence against them? It appears that that was the case as well. So, you know, I think it's really important that when we are trying to analyze these moments that we're not reductive about socioeconomic phenomena like destructive protest or looting. And, you know, the other thing I'll say is that I think there's an important distinction between measuring the efficacy of violent protests or destructive protests and versus the morality of it. The morality of it is going to be personal and subjective. Most of us can think of moments and places where we find violence or destruction useful and justified, and moments where we don't. Now, the efficacy of it is something that we can probably wrap our heads around. But again, it's complicated. If the point is to get attention, then destruction works. If the point is to win hearts and minds and the political center, then it probably doesn't. And if holding public officials hostage and forcing them to appease your demands is the point, it might depend on the public official. And so to kind of step back from all that for a minute, I think something that you'll hear a lot and I've heard a lot in the recent days is, you know, that two wrongs don't make a right, which is an ethical and spiritual intuition in many traditions, but it's not a particularly American one. Our whole criminal justice system is based on the premise that two wrongs make a right. Caging humans and fining poor people money they don't have are morally wrong. but it's how we define justice in most cases in this country. But to go to your specific question about the research on de-escalating tense situations, there's research from as early as the 1967 Kerner Commission, which was, of course, this landmark federal effort to investigate urban unrest that was occurring in places like Watts and Detroit. And social scientists found that these abrasive policing actions can be really pivotal in turning peaceful demonstrations towards violence or destruction. And they recommended that police eliminate those tactics and cities establish fair ways for citizens to address their complaints against the police.
What were some of the tactics that were singled out as escalating violence instead of preventing it?
Yeah, so those will be things like clearing streets, right? Declaring a protest illegal and telling everyone that they need to move on and kind of setting up this, I don't know if they describe it as a phalanx, right? But when all of the officers line up along the street with their riot gear and basically just start pushing people out. Some of the kettling tactics that are used to make mass arrests. Even just what officers are wearing, right? Like, are they showing up to a peaceful protest in full riot gear with batons and with weapons used to fire chemical munitions into the crowd? Or are they showing up looking like peace officers? All of that contributes to how crowds interpret what the police are there for.
Yeah, and you're right that research shows if police go one step higher, so will the protesters.
That's right. In a lot of ways, I think the logic behind escalation and de-escalation, you don't necessarily need a study to understand how that works, right? I think most of us recognize in our own life that escalation brings escalation, right? If you approach a situation in the most aggressive way that you can think to approach it, that often elicits an aggressive or defensive response from the person that you're dealing with. So the research is interesting and useful, and departments should be taking stock of it, but you don't actually need a study to tell you that approaching people aggressively can lead to worse outcomes than approaching them with humanity.
You know what I think is really interesting? After the police moved in on protesters in Washington, D.C. on Monday, June 1st, and they used tear gas and pepper spray and smoke, and this was the night of the evening of Trump's now famous Bible photo op, we've seen so many just huge, massive, peaceful protests since then. I mean, the reaction seemed to be almost like doubling down on peaceful protests.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, again, there's tactical adjustments that are happening in the moment, right? If there's a recognition that the destruction is creating a bad narrative, then I think organizers are redoubling their efforts to make sure that everyone, as much as possible, everyone who's at protests is sticking to a message and sticking to a script. I think there's also a degree to which the bad actors or the disingenuous actors are getting bored and they're just not showing up to protests looking to sow chaos in the ways that they were. But the committed movement folks, you know, who were doing this work before George Floyd, those are the ones who are continuing to plan rallies and continuing to make sure that they are having the effect that they're looking for.
You know, I think there's so much anger and frustration because of years and years and years of racism within police departments and disproportionate numbers of Black men and women killed during arrest or while in police custody. Years of protests, years of promised reforms, and we're still seeing the same kinds of problems. So let's look at an example. Let's look at Minneapolis. There were promised reforms before George Floyd's death, and still George Floyd died with an officer's knee on his neck. What were some of the reforms that were promised or that were actually supposed to be initiated, and what led to those reforms?
you know, just to take a step back, Malcolm X once said, "You can't legislate goodwill," and I think it's maybe one of the most astute political observations of our time. And if I can take the liberty of elaborating on it, I'd say you can't regulate goodwill or implement it with a consent decree or a strategic policy initiative either. So yes, we can outline specific line level reforms that were promised and not implemented, or implemented unevenly or ineffectively. Like, let's take neck restraints, for example. Many departments have chosen to ban those outright. But when the Minneapolis Police Department addressed them in 2014, they chose to leave this carve out where if deadly force was permissible, then so too was this kind of restraint. And it maybe makes sense that if you're legally justified to pull out your gun and shoot someone, you're also justified to choke them. I mean, that's the argument that's typically made, and a lot of use of force policies make it. But by leaving that carve out, there's a significant ambiguity there in the policy. You're asking officers, sort of in the heat of the moment, or in the heat of several moments, to make a distinction about whether or not this particular situation merits or you know makes it reasonable to restrain someone's neck in that way. But putting aside that specific example, like a lot of changes were made. The Minneapolis Department adopted a slew of changes after this voluntary review in 2013 by the U.S. Department of Justice. And they automated their system for flagging problem officers, as the Department of Justice recommended. They rewrote their use of force policy with a focus on the quote-unquote sanctity of life. They required officers to intervene when a fellow cop became abusive in front of them. And all of those would seem to be measures that would have lessened the possibility that an incident like what happened to George Floyd would happen. But they didn't. And so I think that's going to beg some really tough questions moving forward for reformers about why not. And I kind of think it comes back to the words of Malcolm X. If there is a culture in an organization whereby the application of force to black bodies is the norm, that's the expectation. It's the MO. You can't really policy change that away. And you know, the news that the city plans to disband its police department and kind of functionally start over again seems to be a recognition of that fact, as does this newfound popularity broadly of defund and abolition movements.
I think if somebody is racist or afraid of black men, feels threatened by black men, then I don't know that like a diversity training session is necessarily going to change that. Do you think that have there been any efforts in police departments to screen out people who are racist? And I don't know exactly like what the screening process would be, but I think what you're saying is like if there is a racist culture or if there are racists within a police department, then policies aren't necessarily going to change how they see things and how they react to things.
Yeah, I mean, I've always found it instructive to think of the police and policing as this kind of avatar of American racism. The police are racism representatives. They are the folks who we hire to actuate something that's far more distant than a person's individual biases. So like I'm sure listeners will be familiar with the Central Park incident involving Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper a few weeks back. A white woman who was walking her dog off leash, this black man, Christian Cooper, asked her to put her dog on the leash per the park rules. And she instantly seemed to feel very threatened and started calling the police and telling them that she was being physically threatened by a black man. This went viral just before George Floyd was killed. And part of the reason that the Amy Coopers of the world feel so comfortable using the police as their own kind of personal racism valet is because that's in line with how they've operated in our society, which is to say, even if you or I or we have never called the police on a black person for some deeply unserious reason, as a society, we outsource the keeping of the racial order to police every day. Officers themselves don't have to, and this is like so important, officers themselves do not have to be ideologically white supremacist to be performing that function. So we spend a lot of time on this surface level question of how do we get police officers as individuals or as departments to treat black people better. But in sum, the way police treat black people in America is symptomatic of how America feels about black people, which is this state of conditional citizenship steeped in mistrust and in fear. And I don't mean with this answer to kind of expand the issue into something so big that it becomes an abstraction either. Like, you can recruit better. You can catch problems more quickly. You can train people better. You can create better incentives. And it's been done. Like, bad police departments have improved before. But I do intend to take the onus off of police officers as this bad other who do harm because they are sociopaths and put it on all of us. Like, what we get from police is consistent with what we as a society have internalized about black worth and about what constitutes order and justice. And so that to me is part of the reason why defunding and abolition has captured as much traction as it has in recent days. And I don't think that that conversation is one that necessarily has to be interpreted as a punitive response that, you know, policing is bad, so let's take its money away so we can, you know, get a police department so small we can drown it in the proverbial bathtub. I think, you know, rather, if there's one thing police and their sharpest detractors can agree on, and it literally may be just this one thing, it's that we assign entirely too much of our social safety net to police in ways that are at best unfair, and at worst lead to tragic and predictable outcomes. So if defunding the police is coincident with funding less confrontational strategies for handling social issues, it may actually leave both sides happier. You can imagine a world where police would be more like fire people, right? And they're in the firehouse and they're up there. And then when the alarm goes off and they're absolutely needed, they slide down the pole and they show up because the only recourse in this situation is the strategic use of force. But that there's so many things that we currently ask our police to respond to, whether it's a noise complaint or a car accident, that don't necessarily fit into a reason why someone would need to show up with a deadly weapon and with the authority to use that deadly weapon to deprive someone of their civil rights or their life.
I think this must be a very difficult time for police officers in the sense that there's this huge movement to disband or defund the police, which translates for a lot of police officers into possibly there's a huge movement for them to lose their jobs. And I'm wondering if you've been talking to a lot of police officers about what their concerns are about what defunding the police or disbanding them would mean for them.
I do think what advocates of this approach are asking police officers to do, or I guess are asking society to do, and asking police officers to be okay with, is that we reimagine the number of people with guns and the right to take someone's civil rights away, how many of those you need to have a healthy society. So yeah, I mean, if the question is, you know, is there fear and anger, frustration among police officers in America, the ones who I've spoken to, or just generally, yeah, that's absolutely the true, right? That's absolutely the case. We're in what really feels like an unprecedented moment where this industry is being questioned in ways that it never was before, even through Ferguson, even through Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and Eric Garner and all of these other moments where the national attention shifted to policing. You're hearing so much less of the few bad apples argument and so much more of the what is wrong with this system? What is wrong with this approach to how we deal with problems in our society, right? The anger and the frustration among the communities that police serve is so much more general, and it's so much less specific this time. To me, that's the big difference. So, you know, is there fear? Is there concern? Absolutely. But you know, I think one of the things that I also think is important to think about is that policing wasn't always this way. It wasn't always this big. It wasn't always this bureaucratic. It wasn't always right. Modern policing, the policing that sort of you and I and listeners recognize today, is really a product of the 20th century. And so, you know, there is a degree to which sometimes as a society, you need to rethink institutions, especially when they're relatively new, especially when they've changed a lot over the last 20, 30 or 40 years, and come to a decision as a society on, you know, whether is the direction that we've gone the direction that we need to go moving forward.
Jamiles Larte, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I so appreciate you having me.
Jamiles Larte writes about criminal justice, race, and policing for the nonprofit news organization, The Marshall Project. He spoke to us from his home in New Orleans. The writer-director Spike Lee has been busy during this time of pandemic and protest. He released two short films, New York, New York, featuring images of the city's quiet streets during lockdown, and Three Brothers, Radio Raheem, Eric Garner, and George Floyd, in response to the police killings of black men. His new feature film, Defive Bloods, follows a group of black war vets who returned to Vietnam decades later on a personal mission. It just started streaming on Netflix. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Spike Lee's Defive Bloods was supposed to open in select theaters until the COVID-19 pandemic hit and forced Netflix to change its plans. You could call that unfortunate timing, except that amid nationwide protests against racism and police violence, the movie could hardly be timelier. Lee has, of course, never been shy about confronting these subjects in films like Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, and the recent Black Klansman. His latest, even though it takes place in present-day Vietnam, is no exception. Defive Bloods follows a group of black war veterans who fought together in Vietnam in 1971. Now four of them have returned to that country decades later. Their reunion in Ho Chi Minh City begins on a funny, celebratory note. Clark Peters plays Otis, the cool-headed planner behind their trip. Isaiah Whitlock Jr. and Norm Lewis are Melvin and Eddie, on hand to provide warm vibes and comic relief. And then there's Paul, played in a standout performance by Delroy Lindo, a fixture of Lee's 90s films like Crooklyn. Paul's post-war life has been full of loss and disappointment, and he emerges as the movie's most complicated and emotionally ravaged character. The fifth blood is their squad leader, affectionately known as Stormin Norman, who was killed in combat in 71. His death still haunts all of them, especially Paul, who is consumed with guilt for not having saved his comrade's life.
I see ghosts, y'all. I see ghosts.
What happens to all of us, man?
Have you seen them too?
Yeah.
Dad come to you at night. Storm and Norm comes to me damn near every night. Now he talked to you like he talked to me.
Come on.
I don't think so.
Come on.
Stormin Norman is played by the charismatic Chadwick Boseman of Black Panther in several exciting, combat-heavy flashbacks. We see Norman and the other four Bloods being sent into the Vietnamese jungle to recover a stash of gold bars from a downed U.S. plane. The gold is meant to buy the allegiance of local fighters against the Viet Cong, but the Bloods, upon finding it, make other plans. The screenplay is credited to Lee, Kevin Wilmot, Danny Bilson, and Paul DeMeo, and it lays out the Bloods' rationale with unsurprising bluntness, sometimes cutting away from the story to provide historical context and sometimes injecting that context into the character's own dialogue. They talk about the horrors of slavery, the struggles of the civil rights movement, and the grossly disproportionate number of black soldiers who were sent to fight and die in Vietnam. And so the Bloods, making their own case for reparations, decide to bury the gold and return for it at a later date, vowing to use it to benefit their communities. Lee loves his polemics, but he also loves classic Hollywood, and for all its urgency, The Five Bloods plays like an old-fashioned action-adventure saga, complete with references to films like Apocalypse Now and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Personally, it reminded me of Richard Linklater's Vietnam vet drama, Last Flag Flying, with a bit of Rambo-esque carnage sprinkled in. It's also a companion piece to Lee's World War II drama, Miracle at St. Anna, another critique of the U.S.'s long, shameful history of devaluing its black soldiers. At 2 hours and 35 minutes, The Five Bloods is an unwieldy sprawl. It's like a platoon picture, a heist thriller, a history lesson, and a grumpy old men comedy rolled into one, spliced together with documentary footage and a Marvin Gaye-heavy soundtrack. There are a lot of supporting characters, too, including a Vietnamese businesswoman whom Otis knew during the war, and three humanitarian workers who specialize in clearing old landmines. One key subplot involves Paul's son, played by Jonathan Majors from last year's The Last Black Man in San Francisco. He tags along for the trip, and his strained relationship with his dad adds a dose of melodrama to a picture that's already bursting at the seams. But even at its most unwieldy, I found it easy to forgive The Five Bloods its excesses, and to simply go along with these characters on their wildly unpredictable and ultimately devastating journey. You could accuse Spike Lee of trying to do and say too much, and you wouldn't be the first one to do so. He can be a maddeningly undisciplined storyteller, but also a generous and thoughtful one. There's something both moving and essential about his attempt to reclaim the Vietnam War film from a black perspective. He's made a loving throwback to the Hollywood war movies of yesteryear that can't help but make you think about all the stories those movies never got around to telling.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Spike Lee's new film, The Five Bloods. It just started streaming on Netflix. My guests are Pete Davidson and Judd Apatow. Davidson stars in the new film, The King of Staten Island, which is now available on demand. Apatow co-wrote the film with Davidson, and he directed it. Pete Davidson was 20 years old when he joined the cast of Saturday Night Live. For the past six seasons, he's been the show's youngest cast member. If you're a fan, it's easy to feel like you know him, because he's hilarious appearing on Weekend Update as himself, whether it's talking about his mental health issues, dating famous women, or growing up on Staten Island, where he's now living with his mother. Here's what he had to say about Staten Island, talking on Weekend Update in 2017 with Colin Jost, who's also from Staten Island.
No, don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. I know Staten Island isn't all heroin and racist cops, you know? It also has meth and racist firefighters.
I just want to say, what you're describing is not the Staten Island I know, Pete.
Well, because they love you. You know, like, because you represent what they could be. You know, a kid who got out, he went to Harvard, and now, apparently, according to People magazine, is the world's sexiest joke writer. And look, the reason Staten Island hates me is because I represent what they are. You know, a mentally ill community college dropout who got a Game of Thrones tattoo before watching the show.
Another thing many of Davidson's fans know about him is that his father was a firefighter who died in service at Ground Zero on 9/11. Davidson was 7 years old. The King of Staten Island is a fictionalized version of how that traumatic loss affected him. It's a drama with comedy. Davidson's character, Scott, is kind of like the person Davidson might have been had he not become obsessed with comedy as a teenager and started performing. Scott's father was a firefighter who died in the line of duty. Scott has never gotten over his father's death, and although he's in his 20s, he's still stuck in adolescence. He lives with his mother, spends most of his time smoking weed with his friends, and giving them tattoos. He's actually a pretty good tattoo artist, but has no idea how to harness that talent. Judd Apatow has written, directed, and produced many films and has discovered and mentored many talented comic actors. Films he directed include The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Trainwreck, which starred Amy Schumer. Let's start with a scene from early in The King of Staten Island, when Scott's younger sister is about to leave home for college. His sister is played by Maud Apatow, Judd Apatow's daughter.
Be nice to Mom, okay? Don't give her a hard time. She deserves a break.
I always give her a break. When am I going to get my break? Like,
what are you talking about? All anyone ever does is worry about you. I was ignored my entire childhood because of you.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that my childhood was so dandy.
Okay, you don't get that crazy your whole life just because Dad died, okay? At least you got to know him.
Well, you're lucky you didn't get to know him, okay? Because that's why you're almost normal. If you got to know him, you would have known that he was, like, the coolest guy ever. And that would have ruined the rest of your life.
Okay, like, but what are you going to do? Are you going to get a job or are you going to leave the house?
I don't know. I'm going to open that tattoo restaurant.
No, like, for real.
I am being real. It's never been done before. I looked it up. I Googled it. It's never been done, not even as a joke.
Because no one wants to go to a restaurant and watch people get tattooed while they eat. It's gross.
It's the best idea ever. Ruby Tattoos Days, where everyone's welcome. Chicken and tattoos.
That's not a business. You know, you gotta get your together. Time is passing by very quickly.
That's why I smoke weed all the time, okay? It slows it all down.
See, I'm worried about you.
Why now? Like, what gives? You never looked out for me once.
You're my older brother. You're supposed to look out for me.
You're just guilty because you're leaving? Now all of a sudden you're afraid I'm going to die? I was going to die anyway, whether you stay or not.
Are you going to hurt yourself?
Probably. Yeah, I'm probably going to hurt myself. I don't know how, but yeah. If anybody could do it, it's me.
Pete Davidson, Judd Apatow, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film. I really love it. It's something that you obviously both have in common. You were both obsessed with comedy in your teens. I mean, you ran around like interviewing every comic that you could, and you have a book collecting those interviews. And Pete, you were doing stand-up when you were 15. So is that a bond between the two of you, that early obsession that has continued through your lives?
It's certainly a bond for me. I mean, we're both complete comedy nerds. You know, we're fans of comedy in addition to, you know, people who started doing stand-up at a young age. I know for me, I first became aware of Pete when we were casting Trainwreck, and I asked Amy, you know, who should I know? Who might we want to put in the movie?
And the Amy is Amy Schumer, who starred in Trainwreck.
That's right. And the first person she mentioned was Pete. And then we just went on YouTube and watched a bunch of clips of Pete, and they were hysterical. And then she told me he was 20 years old, which angered me because I was so unfunny at 20. And it just seemed crazy how sophisticated and riotously funny his act was at such a young age. And it reminded me of when I met Adam Sandler when he was a similar age and I was the same age as Adam. I saw him at the comic strip in New York really late at night. And I just thought, well, I guess that's the guy. You know, I know it's not me. I think it's that guy. And, you know, Pete certainly has some similarities to Adam in the sense that he's funny, super young and brash and from New York. And I would say this, and I'm sure Adam would agree, he was way funnier at 20 than either of us were.
Pete, let me ask you, since so much of the movie revolves around the character's father's death, fighting a fire in a hotel, which is different than your father, who died fighting a fire on 9/11 at Ground Zero. You were 7 when your father died. How did your mother tell you what happened?
It was really tricky, because it happened while I was at school. I pretty much got picked up and was told I was not allowed to watch television. And my mom really didn't, nobody really knew what was, going on, because it happened so fast and, they were still getting information. So I didn't really find out that my dad was involved until a couple of days after, or like a week into it. And then once they started showing missing persons on the television, my mom had to break it to me that, you know, there's a chance that your father might not come home.
So when you were 7, did you have a sense of what 9/11 was?
I didn't really understand what it was, but I definitely knew that something was wrong and that my mom was scared. And I could definitely sense that there was something wrong in the world.
Your parents had divorced 6 months before 9/11. That must have just like added to the trauma.
Yeah, it was. We were just getting used to that sort of visitation schedule, and it definitely made things a lot harder, for sure.
You know, your character thinks that firefighters shouldn't have families because firefighters are selfish. They miss birthdays. They hang out together and don't go home. Sometimes they don't come home for good. Did you believe that when you were growing up, and how do you feel about that now?
I think initially when I was little and that happened to me, I definitely felt that like maybe it wasn't a job for people who had families because of the consequences that could happen if, you know, God forbid you passed away on the job. But as I got to meet with these firemen and my dad's friends and just see how much they really loved what they were doing and the sacrifices that they were making and how important that job actually is, it made me feel differently towards it. And now I think a lot differently.
How did you get to talk with them about that?
One of my dad's friends and a bunch of, you know, his colleagues were consultants on the film. And we got to be, you know, in the firehouse, and I just got to see the camaraderie and just the friendships and the bonds that these people had with each other. And, you know, they were brothers and they were going into battle together. And I just think that it's just a necessary, you know, selfless job to have. And I think it's, you know, really important.
Was that the end of your sentence, or did you? I wasn't sure if that was.
Oh no, yeah, it was really important. I got a little choked up there.
Oh, okay.
I just think it's I just think it's a really important, necessary job, and we're lucky to have people that are willing to do that, and they're all heroes.
You learned about death from your father dying at Ground Zero, where he was fighting a fire. He was a firefighter. I know you've had suicidal thoughts. I know that because you've said that in your comedy. Do you see any connection between having your father die so young and knowing that a life can be taken so quickly and having some suicidal thinking yourself?
Yeah, I think, you know, usually a kid learns about death in high school. Usually there's a kid in high school that passes away, unfortunately. And, you know, you're a little older and able to deal with it, and you're able to grieve with people. I was only 7, so it was such a shock. And to have it be somebody so close to me, I think it really taught me that, like, you know, life is certainly precious and nobody has anything guaranteed. So being suicidal is just, I always, you know, wanted to be with my dad, so that's where those thoughts come from. I just want to, you know, I really love the guy and I just wanted to hang with him. So I think that's where they come from.
Pete, on stage, you draw on traumatic experiences in your life, like your father's death. You draw on your own mental health problems and you turn it into something funny. That's hard to do because you don't want people to feel sorry for you when you're on stage. You want them to think about their own lives. You want them to empathize with you and to laugh. At what point in your life did you feel like you could make that work, that you could transform difficult parts about your life and your feelings, your emotions, and make it funny and make it something people would care about?
When my father passed and, you know, having, you know, suicidal thoughts, these are things that I really struggled with, and they really are scary, and they scared me. And I think when you're able to make somebody laugh or make a joke out of the darkest thing, it's healing, and it makes you feel a lot better. So my goal was always to just bring light to the darkness.
When you were talking in depth with firefighters who had worked with your father while you were making your new movie, and you were learning new things about your father you didn't know, did it change your impressions of your father?
When I grew up, I felt this tremendous amount of pressure because I was told from 7, like, your dad's a hero, like, he's the greatest, he made the ultimate sacrifice. So, you know, that's a lot to live up to when you're, you know, young and trying to find yourself. So I always felt tremendous amount of pressure to, you know, try and, you know, match that or top that. How am I ever going to do that? And when I talked to his friends in depth about him, and I found out that, you know, he had his issues just like everybody else, and he was a bit of a party guy, and, you know, it was the reason my parents, you know, got divorced, and it really, like, alleviated a lot of that stress off of me, and it made me realize that even though he is a hero, he does have his faults just like everyone else, and it kind of, in a weird way, was comforting because it made me feel okay with my faults.
Do you think that was a problem when you were growing up, that you were measuring yourself against a father who you thought was a perfect hero?
Absolutely. Yeah, I just always wanted to make him proud and, you know, make my mom and sister proud of me. So being told your dad is this, like, almost, you know, untouchable person, it definitely put a lot of stress on me, and it made me feel like I could never amount to anything. But when I talked to his friends, it really helped me, you know, feel better about myself. And my dad, it's nice to know that, like, he was human. You know, it's nice to know that he was a real person.
Pete, in the movie, your character's aspiration is to be a tattoo artist, and he's always tattooing his friends. Do you have a lot of tattoos yourself?
Yes, I'm pretty much covered at this point.
What are they?
They're from, you know, things about my dad to, you know, Stewie Griffin from Family Guy. There's a wide array on my body.
Stewie Griffin from Family Guy? You're going to carry him on you for the rest of your life?
Yeah, absolutely.
People think I have tattoos, but it's actually just an elaborate series of moles.
I read, and you can tell me if this is true, Pete, that you got some of your tattoos to cover up where you cut yourself?
Yes, I got a bunch of those to, you know, fix that problem. But, you know, with a lot of work and, you know, like, just from going to rehabs and talking to doctors and, you know, just all this stuff has been so helpful, especially therapy.
I think, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, we wanted to make the movie and why Pete was excited to make the movie, you know, was to create, you know, a positive, hopeful story about somebody who, you know, starts opening up and getting support. You know, we were trying to do something that was uplifting and honest about the struggles that people go through. And I know, you know, as a parent and being around so many kids, it really is an age where so many people are feeling so much anxiety and depression, and it feels so much worse than when I was a kid. I don't think we knew the word anxiety when I was a kid. No one said they were depressed.
Do you think you were better off not having psychotherapeutic words and psychiatric diagnoses when you were growing up, or do you wish you had it? I mean, you've been in therapy for a long time, so obviously you appreciate the benefits of therapy.
For me, I love all of it. I think everyone should go to the therapist. I think everyone should learn about their psychology. I think we're all traumatized in some way. I was talking about some of this with a friend the other day, and we were saying that when we were kids, I went to high school on Long Island in the early 80s, there wasn't one person who came out of the closet the entire time we were in high school. So you would assume 5 to 10% of our class of 500 people was gay, and they did not feel comfortable enough to express themselves to anybody around them. So, you know, as a parent, what I see is that it's a completely different generation. And I think in a lot of ways, it's so much healthier that people feel like they can talk about all of these things. And it hopefully leads to much happier lives, because certainly forever, everyone felt like any of these issues, you know, were shameful, and you couldn't just be yourself.
Pete, you know, we've talked a lot about your father during the interview, and there's a lot about your character's father in the movie, The King of Staten Island. Do you feel, having made the movie that and talked to his firefighter friends, some of whom are in the movie, that you can move past that a little bit now?
Oh, absolutely. This was the most, like, healthy experience I think I possibly could have had. And it's really a part of my life that I'm ready to move on from. And I think this was the perfect thing for it. And I think it's time that I could move on from it.
Well, I want to thank both of you for talking with us. Thank you for making the movie. Judd Apatow, Pete Davidson, thank you both so much. Please be well.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Pete Davidson stars in the new film, The King of Staten Island. He co-wrote it with Judd Apatow, who also directed the film. It's available on demand.